on the date, March 28th. The date last night was March 28th. It was exactly 45 years to the day when Dr. Martin Luther King spoke at that same church in Newark. 8 days later, April 4th, 1968, he would be gunned down in Memphis, Tennessee. Claudette Colvin, thank you so much for joining us. Civil rights pioneer. It was March 2nd, 1955, that she sat down on the bus as a 15-year-old teenager in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to get up and was arrested. 9 months later, Rosa Parks would do the same thing. Jean Theo Harris, thanks so much for being with us. Author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Happy birthday, Mike Burke.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Everyone, this is the new WHFR Journal for Friday, March the 29th, 2013. Happy Good Friday, although some folks call it Black Friday in history. So you can't necessarily say Happy Black Friday. That doesn't seem right, huh? But and obviously a little bit of sadness if you are into the history as told by the Christian Church. About the death of the historical Jesus, also known as the Son of God, Jesus Christ. His death at Calvary happened on a Friday. That's pretty certain historically, by the way, from several different kinds of documents they find. And the date was either AD 33 or 34. So, big trivia question, Dennis. Dennis Reimar is here with me, Jay Koronick, and Dennis is our WHFR news director. So, okay, how old? When was Jesus born? How old was Jesus when he was killed?
33.
Very good. Or 34. Actually, you know, AD 0, supposedly our calendar is based on the birth of Jesus, according to astronomers who look back and compare it to like the stars or the comets or whatever as described in the Bible accounts, biblical accounts, and other accounts too of the time, he was probably AD 3 or 6, somewhere in there, depending on which you think certain references were to. So maybe he was under 30, because, you know, over 30, nobody would trust him, right?
Right.
Right. So he might have been under 30.
Keep thinking of Logan's Run.
Yeah, not trying to make a joke on it, but no. It is actually a very sad and humbling day if you see Jesus as either a great philosophical teacher, as I do, and also as the Son of God. Wow. And, of course, again, because of his rebirth, and that happens on Easter Sunday, this coming Sunday, the 31st of March this year, that is supposedly the day that he ascended into heaven. And that's the most significant day in the Catholic Church, that resurrection of Jesus Christ on the third day after his crucifixion. And that's really what Christianity is all about, because that means that his words have become, if you will, law and something important to follow. Just some other details here from highly respected Wikipedia.
I'm not even going to touch that.
I was criticizing using that, but, you know, they have footnotes.
Right.
You know, and they're trying hard.
Yeah,
and,
but if you were still teaching and one of your students it as a source, you would.
I would ask them to go to the original source, and they could copy that down from Wikipedia.
Oh, jeez.
But no, seriously, we always want original sources, and Wikipedia is a compendium of sources.
Sure.
Sort of like an encyclopedia. So teachers, you say, well, encyclopedias like World Book or Britannica, they're fairly accurate, right? I mean, Well, yeah, but they're not the original sources. So there, somebody had to interpret the facts and choose the better ones or the more verifiable ones. And so there's actually differences between encyclopedias and, I'm sure, differences between the printed encyclopedias and Wikipedia. So,
do they still print encyclopedias?
Well, I know World Book stopped, and I'm not sure about Encyclopedia Britannica. I think they're all in online or electronic editions.
I have not had a knock on my door regarding that in years.
No, and probably not a Bible salesman either.
Or Fuller Rush, for that matter.
Okay, right. So here's just some other details from Wikipedia about Good Friday. Again, I thought it was interesting that it's referred to as either Holy Friday, Great Friday, Black Friday, or Easter Friday. That's logic, but the Black Friday was unusual. And the date, of course, they're pretty sure it was a Friday. And in fact, even Isaac Newton did a big study. He was, he's one of the two people that are credited with the invention of calculus.
Sure.
Which a lot of engineering students had to suffer through in their freshman year, if they were up to speed out of high school.
I was going
to
say freshman.
They'd have to wait a few years in algebra and geometry. But anyway, Newton was great on biblical studies too, and even looking for Bible codes. In fact, which he didn't tell people about, and they didn't discover until after his death. But he did that calculation. He thought it was AD 34, so close enough anyway. But they know that, you know, we changed from the so-called Julian calendar and the biblical calendar there, and so there's some discrepancies about counting the years, that's the way that goes. However, there was an interesting fact here, and I guess I didn't print that part out, eating. Is that you're still fasting. In fact, some people only eat one meal on Fridays if you're Christian and following the observances. And, of course, Sunday is the big feast day, supposedly. Easter is the end of that 40-day period of fasting, prayer, and penance, unless, of course, you're Irish and you had permission to go crazy on St. Patrick's Day.
Right. Okay. And I think if you're Irish, you automatically have permission.
Well, in Ireland, where it's a national holiday, at least it's totally official. The church says, okay, you can forget about Lent. And that seems to take away the whole idea of the 40-day fast to me. But nonetheless, if you're hungry, eat, I guess.
So just to clarify that, we're not saying that the tenet is to not eat for those 40 days. It's not a fast of 40 days.
No, you're giving up
a specific
some food.
Thing.
It's a fasting. Well, you wouldn't survive.
That's what I'm saying.
Even drinking water, if you don't eat food after about 30 days, you're no longer in this world.
Exactly.
So you can't completely fast, but it's a giving up of a significant
sacrifice.
Food.
Sure.
Yeah.
That was the point.
So it's a symbolic thing, but it is a fasting. Yeah. Actually, the postponement of eating in Ramadan is even a more difficult sort of thing to do. As you know, no food at all for about daylight hours, 12, 14 hours. So that's tough, even though you get to stuff yourself after dark, which is not healthy, I don't think, to eat too much after fasting, even briefly. But nonetheless, Easter is, of course, a movable feast. We never quite know the date. And do you know why, Dennis?
I do not know why.
See, that's why I thought I'd say this today. The first council of Nicaea, which was in 325 A.D., we know that date at least, Roman Catholic council, they decided that the date of Easter, it would be celebrated as the first Sunday after the full moon following the March equinox, that is, the beginning of spring.
Oh, see, I thought it was going to be a difficult formula.
Well, you've got to be an astronomer and know your full moon, I guess, and people can't compute that years in advance, of course. But that's why, as we do it here in the West, so-called Western Church, the date varies between the 22nd of March, that is the beginning of spring, if full moon, one week after the full moon is right there, first Sunday after the full moon is there, all of it could be as late as April 25th. So from March 22nd to April 25th, the date varies according to when the full moon, a week after the full moon following the spring equinox, beginning of spring. However, interestingly, in the Eastern Church, they use the Julian calendar, and so they're going to be off a little bit. And some churches in Detroit area, use that, Eastern Orthodox, for example. And their Easter is anywhere from the 3rd of April 3, to April 4 to the 8th of May. So it's interesting that there's different dates for Eastern celebrations. And I think as Ned Apigian, one of our staff members and a Dearborn Heights Council person, has pointed out for us that even Christmas is celebrated on different dates depending on whether you're the sort of the Western Christian Church or the Eastern Church. That's all wonderful. Of course, Easter is linked to the Jewish Passover also by much of its symbolism. It's almost exactly the same time of year for Jewish Passover in the calendar. But where did this was the last point here, where did the word Easter come from? Well, it turns out that Easter and Passover are, in the history of the development of words, which is called etymology. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a study of bugs.
It's close, but it's not quite.
Anyway, etymology, that somehow Easter and Passover, even to us now, don't sound similar. The words had a root meaning somewhere a long time ago. Before I get to that Easter word, too, what are Easter eggs all about? They're a symbol of what?
Birth? Rebirth?
Oh, the empty tomb of Jesus.
Ooh, really?
So that means if you just cook your eggs and you don't take the inside out, that's not very symbolic.
No.
So think about that, but that's really tough to take the let the egg inside drain out. I've seen people try to do that and then paint the shell.
Absolutely,
which is very delicate and difficult. But they have like a straw and they sort of suck out the insides of the egg. To keep the but that would be the totally traditional part of the symbol because it's supposed to represent the tomb that Jesus' body was put into, and then he rose from that tomb, and then people discovered it 3 days later.
Hey, the rebirth thing was a pretty
empty.
Good guess.
Yeah, okay. And I'm not going to get into the Easter egg hunting, Easter bunny, and Easter parades at this point, but the etymology, a lot of people think that Easter comes from a root name. It's kind of, I think it's pronounced, it's E-O-S-T-R-E, which I would say Esther,
right,
in Middle English. And it's the name of an Anglo-Saxon goddess, a form of the widely attested Indo-European dawn goddess. You know, Easter is always celebrated at the dawn of Sunday. That's why Easter services are often at dawn.
So would that be something that would have been held by the pagans?
Well, exactly,
and
as we
carried over?
Talked in this religious program of ours,
yes.
Which it isn't, but I mean, we mentioned that a lot of Christianity, when it moved into new areas, we're talking about this in regard to St. Patrick coming
sure.
to Ireland, that they would incorporate previous mythologies and so-called sacred locations.
Traditions as well.
Into the church to a certain extent, not too much to contradict Christian church, Catholic church beliefs, but just enough to keep the people coming, get them into the church and make them Christians, in effect. So it's very possible that that Esther, which may not be the goddess, or it might just have meant the month of opening.
Huh.
That is, the opening of the tomb, perhaps, or the beginning of spring, or ascending into heaven, or something like that. So anyway, because I often wondered, and I didn't know I did, but for years I didn't know where the name Easter came from. How is Easter connected? Easter lily, I heard of, and I always see sure. lilies around, so I think, because they use that flower, so that Easter came from, it didn't come from the flower.
It's the bunny's first name. Everybody knows that, Easter Bunny.
Yeah, well, right. Thank you, Dennis.
You're very welcome.
Well, this is the new WHFR Journal, and we are local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area each week, right here on Fridays from 1 to 2 o'clock, or on our website, WHFR.FM, anytime. Just go to WHFR.FM. Click on Talk Shows. We are at the WHFR Journal, and select the date you'd like to hear. And it either plays through the web at that point, or you can download the file. Go out jogging with it or something. From last Sunday, Dearborn Press and Guide. Luckily, our two wonderful weekly papers provide a lot of the grist for the mill, so to speak. Anyway, Tom Watkins has an editorial opinion in there, and he states in detail why support, that is funding from state, local, national for community colleges, is extremely important. I think it's quite obvious that many community colleges, such as the one we're speaking to you from, have extensive programs, many different degrees and certificates, and most classes that are so identified are readily transferable for full credit to a four-year institution. If you want to continue your same program and it needs a four-year degree. And what I found out that's interesting here is that Tom Watkins, and sometimes I disagreed with some of his opinions, but he's very much a, he has a worldview on education, that education for a job and to respond to the needs of the world, that that's extremely important for the future of education. And he went to Henry Ford Community College. I didn't know that, but he graduated from Henry Ford Community College, and I think the story says then he went on to Wayne State, and then he did become the head of the Michigan Department of Higher Ed until he was relatively unceremoniously pushed out by Governor Granholm because he just wouldn't do what she asked him to do and was not a team player as far as she saw it. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean he's a bad person, and he is quite an expert. Now, I've heard him on Craig Folly Show on WDET speaking about educational issues nationally and internationally, but he started here. So most of what he says has got to be pretty good if he began his education at Henry Ford Community College. And he also knows whereof he speaks about community colleges, since he went to community college himself.
I have a question, and there may not be such things as dumb questions, but this might qualify. And you said that he takes a worldview on education. Mm-hmm. How would that be different from, is it incorporating more language? Is it something that down the line you're looking at a more global effect? I don't understand.
Well, first of all, there's a lot of initiatives to education worldwide that we need to be aware of and maybe even incorporate, just like some of the good things we're doing may need to be incorporated elsewhere.
Sure.
So he has traveled wisely. He spent a lot of time in China, especially.
Interesting.
And, of course, the way of the world will probably be the way of business in the world, and China being the largest country in the world, having almost, depending on how you count up exactly which countries are part of China over there, maybe at least a third to a half of the 8 billion people in the world are Chinese, and still growing in their influence worldwide and in business. So we need to know about them and how to relate to them, if not learn Chinese ourselves.
Sure.
Even though they're teaching most of their students English. And so it's just important to know how your life fits into the world and therefore how your education does. That maybe the job you're looking for might not be in this country. It
Sure.
might be in some other country. And it doesn't mean you're going to leave the United States, but I'm just saying that the whole world is, in fact, your platform for your development of your life and the growth of a business in the U.S. probably demands some connection to the rest of the world these days if you want to succeed.
And, of course, we've always talked on this show how it wouldn't hurt the U.S. to look at some of the models. I think healthcare is a great example. Some of the other countries, the way mm-hmm. they're doing things. So, no, I agree completely. I wasn't sure if you were in favor of the worldview.
Yeah.
It does sound like you are.
Yeah, another great writer is Thomas Friedman at the New York Times, who has traveled widely and talks about the economy and has written several books about the worldview for business and career education and, you know, how India got a jump start. I mean, how come they got all the customer service business?
Right.
You know, how come they became so high-tech all of a sudden and we've sort of slipped a little bit? And so it's good to see what the challenges are worldwide, or we're not going to be moving in the right directions to compete.
True.
I think it's just that simple.
Very
so
true.
Anyway, take a look at that. You still have the Sunday Dearborn Pressing Guide around. Their website, by the way, pressingguide.com, does not have all of these editorial opinions.
No, okay? does not.
And so not even all the stories. So maybe they want you to buy a paper. Definitely buy a paper,
no.
Or you won't get all this stuff. You say, well, I'll just go online. They got some of the stuff, but no, they often don't have any of these opinions.
Did you get yours delivered on time?
I did.
Good.
This week. So
Thank you.
Pressing Guide.
Right.
Yes.
They heard
we're back to the standard here.
You're friends again, right?
Everybody slips up every now and then, right?
Yep. It's not what happens to you.
Won't be consequences, though, if you slip up, but right. Everybody does slip. Okay. In the Times Herald competition for Pressing Guide this Wednesday, just a couple things that I noticed there. Wednesday, this is March the 27th. Yes, it's definite. I think it might have been in Pressing Guide before, but Madison Elementary School in Dearborn Heights District 7 is definitely going to close after this school year. They have too few students in all their elementary schools, and it makes sense to close one and move those, in this case, from Madison to other nearby elementary schools. It was debated in the community, but it's the right thing to do in terms of saving money. but obviously some inconveniences. Dennis is also in Dearborn Heights City Government, helping with their cable television. But you're not clear the difference between Dearborn Heights schools and Dearborn Heights District 7.
Well, I am.
They're side by side.
They are, and there's a Crestwood School District, and these are all within the city of Dearborn Heights. So it's a specific, this is on the south end along Annapolis.
But they have their own board of trustees, apparently.
They do. And you've got me really curious now. And we've talked about this a lot. I never really put it together.
Well, what are your next shows on cable TV in Dearborn Heights?
On this station. Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
So we can definitely.
But, maybe next month, Heights News and Views, we can pull the people together.
Well, we have a commitment from Bob Ankrap, who is the city's emergency manager. So we will definitely have at least him on the show.
Well, it's an emergency. It gets over here to the college.
Absolutely.
And that will be, of course, the second Tuesday of April from 1 to 2 o'clock, or as a podcast, right after broadcast from WHFR.FM. We call it the Tuesday Forum, but the second week we try to do Dearborn Heights News and Views, hosted by
myself, Dennis Reimers,
Ned
Opinion, the honorable city council member for Dearborn
Heights.
That's
right. And they're all honorable, aren't they?
As far as I can tell, but I don't know.
Not just Ned, but yes. It's an honorary term.
I keep looking for the holes there, but no, they're good people.
And you may have heard, but we were getting these teasers for weeks. Dearborn and Melvindale fire departments are going to merge. They're in negotiations. They're getting close. And it's just funny to me because it's almost every week there's a story about them inching closer. But has it happened? No, it hasn't happened yet. So has it happened today? No, it hasn't happened today. But what happened was that the firefighters themselves, the two unions of the Dearborn and the Melvindale firefighters, they individually voted to accept a merger under certain sort of terms, I guess, equal treatment, maybe their contracts have to be sort of combined.
Well, they have to decide who's in charge, too. Somebody has to be the chief.
Well, who decides grievances and other problems? Mm-hmm. So the unions really have to merge as well as the two organizations, and of course, then decide, well, what fires are we going to put out? who do we call? Maybe if it's on the border somewhere, you get Melvindale department or the people previously who were part of Melvindale to come and put out your Dearborn fire.
Well, and from my experiences with this similar situation, Dearborn Heights was talking about, same thing, talking about for a long time, merging with Garden City. They bring the unions to the table pretty early. So this last vote was kind of a formality based on what I saw over there. So they had kind of already had things lined up. But, of course, the city councils are the final approval, aren't they?
That's right. So we're still waiting for that. So wait till next week's headlines, folks. They'll be maybe the final chapter on the merger of the two fire departments.
It seems inevitable, though.
Yeah. How close is the Garden City Dearborn Heights?
Not as
merger?
Close as Dearborn.
Really?
And Melvindale.
And yet they have a lot more contiguous border.
Well,
they're right next door, if you will.
There's the
Garden City and Dearborn Heights.
The south end has on Telegraph, and that's not even close. So, logistically, it can work out. I think there's been delays for whatever reason, and it hasn't been put in front of council.
Mm-hmm.
More important things? I don't know. I really don't.
I suspect the city of Melvindale may be in worse financial difficulty than Dearborn, too, and that was a big reason for trying to beef up their firefighting by merging with a better and bigger department. It has more equipment, more specialized services. It made sense for them to do it, and I'm sure there are certain advantages to Dearborn, but
and I wouldn't be surprised if other communities start to get involved in that. I mean, not just two, but maybe Allen Park would be a logical partner if they would decide to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, while we were talking about the Dearborn Heights, the District 7, I know this was, I don't know if we had covered this before, but the teachers agreed to a new contract, and that did pass in Dearborn Heights District 7, but it included a 4.5% pay cut. And this is after 2 years of freezes on their salaries.
Yep.
So but you know what? They want to keep working. Yeah. And the bottom line is that this does give them the ability to move forward. So they have a new contract.
And it's under the wire of the right to work law coming in.
Yes,
so,
good point.
Republican legislators were criticizing all the colleges, universities, and some school districts that rushed to these contracts. But the school districts and Wayne State tried to point out, but some legislators weren't listening. You know, this is bad, those long multi-year contracts, and you're trying to avoid the law. And we're saving money. Yeah. For whatever reason, these people who wanted to keep their union, and it's not a closed job situation, folks. You know, right to work when it comes in, it means that, yeah, you can be in there, and you don't have to join the union. Over time, that can certainly hurt union membership and so on. But the present situation, extending the present situation, means that you can still choose not to join, but you have to pay the union dues for the negotiations that give you the benefits, that give you the coverage. So, you know, right now, that's a situation. Anybody can work anywhere. There is right to work in Michigan. Always has been in the United States. But you may have to pay the portion of union dues if there's a union representation going on there that the union needs for during their negotiation sessions.
Okay.
And
that seems fair.
Yeah, but nonetheless, in a way, because the unions, and I guess it's a little bit ironic, because the unions now, in many places, have locked in their protection for their union for a greater period of time, they've had to take significant cost reductions and benefit reductions for that contract. The schools and the universities are not giving anything away here. They're happy about these last-minute contracts. Otherwise, they would have fought them. They're happy about them because they've got locked-in savings now that they wouldn't have had without the pressure of the unions wanting some protection for themselves. So, you know, giving up money for the sake of maintaining your solidarity, it was the trade-off that almost all of these workers have agreed to. And for security, I mean, a 5, 6, 8-year contract is more secure from the workers. And guess what? Even the administration, they don't have to get their lawyers together and pay for negotiations all over again.
Oh, yeah, that's
for 5 or 6 or 8 years, whatever it is. So it's, you know, I think it benefits the schools and universities more, despite what a few Republican legislators were haranguing about. I think maybe the union should have thought twice about, you know, fighting this. But they made their point, I think, about their solidarity and about, you know, how Lansing can go against the will of the people, like they did with the Detroit Emergency Manager Law that's in effect now. When people in November voted, the majority of people who voted last November said, we don't want this. We don't want this. And then the legislature, you remember, in December voted something similar back in. And it's the first city, certainly of this size in the whole country, that is under control and edict and with no responsibility to contracts or locally elected leaders. The first time it's ever happened in the United States of America at this size. And as Jack Lessenberry points out in his Metro Times column this week, and he's all in favor of just solving the problem with his emergency manager or whatever, and he feels that the city just didn't do it on its own. Certainly there's a potential problem here with almost every city being under that sort of dictatorial control. Michigan Constitution, though, interestingly, the Constitution that we chose not to review and not to modify, not to have a constitutional convention about it after 17 years. We voted, was it last year? We voted, or the year before, we voted not to have a constitutional convention. Two years ago. But one of the things in our Constitution, it says that cities only exist at the will of, cities in Michigan only exist at the will of the state. So the state, if it wants to, can completely, if you will, disenfranchise any city, do away with them, form a new city. They could do away with all the cities in the Tri-County area and make it one big Detroit by just passing a law, which I think they should do, maybe even larger than the Tri-County area, because we need that larger metropolis and that tax base to solve the problems of this region. Everybody that knows urban planning and sees what works in other parts of the country knows that that's needed. But, of course, that's so controversial, it'll never happen.
And I just saw a blurb on television that Dan Gilbert is talking about a 2-year plan to totally revitalize the city of Detroit. Dan Gilbert, of course, is the – what was it before Quicken? Was it Rock Financial? Mm-hmm. Anyway, he started that. And he made enough money doing that to buy a professional basketball team. So that's not small change. Anyway.
No, I guess not.
Anyway, but he wants to do something with the city, and he has a lot of people on board. Some of the people downtown, I don't know if Illich fits into this, but he certainly is buying up his share of the land down there, too.
You know, I thought it was an interesting comment how you know, the Detroit Police Department is going to be helped out a lot by new cars and new organization or new technology provided by a number of private companies. And so some people said, oh, my God, RoboCop, you know, which is where a city, and it's said to be Detroit,
sure,
in the future, they just privatized the police force to a business, to
was
a company.
Peter Weller?
Yeah, Peter Weller was in, I think, the first two. I don't think the last one.
I didn't even see the second.
They were, because he's in that costume, so who could tell it's Peter Weller anyway?
Right.
Just cast somebody that charges less, but has a similar nose and half face, you know.
Right.
You know, it's certainly true. It's a problem. You don't want outside companies to take over vital public services, and especially one that's military-like, like the police, with all their guns and tanks and so
Absolutely.
On. Absolutely. You don't want private industry to take that over and then, because they got all the guns, you know, and all the tanks, so they might decide not to do what the people want or even what the state wants, you know. You don't want to set up, I mean, this has been proven in history throughout Europe and elsewhere, you don't want to set up a mercenary army.
That's exactly what it would be, too.
That has no competition and no constraint if it wanted to do what it wanted to do. So in this case, they're just giving them cars and technology. And but I thought it was interesting. Somebody said, "Homo RoboCop."
I mean, on the other end of the slide, or whatever you want to call it, the line, they're talking about paying new police officers just coming in $14 an hour, and that seems a little bit low to pay somebody
for a job that dangerous and requires such specialized skills and knowledge of the laws.
And if they do have to contribute to their health insurance or any of their insurance or their benefits, and I mean, that's not a lot of money a base to
no,
work
if it's
with.
Taken out of that. No, certainly, right. That's pretty low. I think the highest paid police right now are in Los Angeles, believe it or not.
The lowest would be in Detroit, of a major city.
Probably, yeah. Well, just wanted to go briefly on this, and we have Jim Hightower has a couple comments about what are they today? Oh, Bullish on Bullets is the title of one comment, and Wall Street Banksters.
All right.
What are they doing these days? That's interesting. Okay. But George Delaney, he has an editorial, and we have a call-in to have him on the show in the next month or so, and hopefully he can come by, hopefully at the end of April is what we're targeting for. You know, some of those tax changes that were passed in 2011, you know, when Snyder first came into office, retired residents, as he points out, like myself, have already felt the effects of the retirement tax in their monthly checks. Many families that have relied on exemptions and credits will find them reduced or gone this year, he points out. And, of course, he's a Democrat. He didn't vote for him. He says there's no longer a $600 per child deduction or a $2,300 senior exemption. Also, the earned income tax credit, that's EITC, for low and middle class families is reduced from 20% to 6%.
Wow.
Instead of being available to taxpayers earning less than $82,650, the homestead property tax, HPTC, is reduced and will only be available to individuals earning $50,000 per year or less, and homesteads with a taxable value of less than $135,000. Some senior citizens who once qualified for 100% credit will now qualify for something less than 100% credit. Retirement benefits, as he said, are taxable. Like for some individuals based on age, I have a Michigan teacher's pension that I get from the state. Thank you. That's what I expected, and that's what I'm getting. Joint filer's pensions are taxed based on the age of the eldest joint filer, too, interestingly. People born before 1946 will see no change. And, of course, I was born in 1946.
Oh, okay.
Right. And so I'll see a change. And was that totally fair? If I was 1 year older...
You know, they didn't single you out.
You know, I know. They just picked a date at random. They call it the baby boomer generation,
okay.
Supposedly when World War II was over.
Everybody came back and had families.
But I was conceived during World War II. That should mean something, right?
All right.
Okay. Not in a court of law, perhaps.
Yeah, you try to fight it. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, anyway... people born from 46 to 52 will be taxed on retirement income above $20,000. We have a slightly reduced thing. It was a big to-do when it first came out. If you were born after 52 and you are in retirement or pension, then you have to take the full hit, which I think is 6%. It doesn't say here, but it's still it adds up. Yeah, 6%. Non-refundable tax credits that are no longer allowed, including credits for college tuition, city income taxes, You can't deduct those on your state tax anymore. Automobile donations to charities, can't do that.
Why?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
Just because they want more money at the state, so they got to cut out donations
at the same
and other tax credits.
I get it. At the same time, these vehicles go through places like Charity Motors, and they get the money back.
But also, why do they go after the nonprofit donations? Right. Aren't there some nice, big corporate loopholes in Michigan? We know there are at the national level. Why don't they close those? Why don't they make all corporations in Michigan pay the same tax? I know there's some corporate deductions. I'm positive. I don't know what they are. And of course, all opinions on this show are not necessarily those of Henry Ford Community College. And what do I know? I'm probably wrong on that. But I can guarantee you there's some special tax exemptions for Ford Motor Company, which may or may not be the same as for Chrysler and or GM and other companies. Why? Well, so they don't run to another state to get some tax credits
there. They
have
leverage.
Well, that's not fair. There should be a national law saying they can't do that. You know, in fact, there should be a corporate tax for the whole darn country. Not too high. Okay, I'm not crazy. But so they can't play one state off the other. Sure, they can still say, well, your state is closer to highways or railroads for transportation or waterways if we're going to ship overseas. You know, I mean, come on there. So George Durrani concludes by saying that all these credits will primarily create hardship for middle-class families, and they will hurt the local nonprofit groups who will see reduced donations. And he says, during these tough times, more families have relied on these groups and the services they provide to make ends meet. So it's a double whammy for the middle class and the poor. And he says, my Democratic colleagues and I will continue fighting for tax reform. We don't want a tax system that unfairly takes money out of retirement checks or the wallets and savings of our hardworking middle-class families who are struggling to provide basic necessities and ensure that their kids have a chance at a college education. It goes on a little past that, but that's the summary there. And that's his opinion. We'll ask him details about that and all the other range of issues, what's happening in the state when we get him in the studio here, probably for a full hour. Usually we say half an hour sometimes to him, but by golly, things come up, and we just want the details, and he's got them. So
not only that, sometimes he's in the area, but he gets here a little bit late, so we can't. We have to make sure he gets his fare.
Yeah, I think if we get him on the 26th that Friday, he's going to come from the senior facility within the center here in Dearborn, I don't think he can leave till about 1 o'clock, so he might be a few minutes after the hour when he gets here. Sure. Let's listen to Jim Hightower now, and we'll be back with a lot more local news and views for Dearborn and the surrounding area.
Many people buy in bulk. Why purchase toilet paper a 4-pack at a time, goes their thinking, when I can make one trip and pick up a year's supply? This stock-up mentality can make sense, up to a point. A year's supply of toilet paper? Check. But 100 years' worth? What, are you nuts? Which brings us to the Department of Homeland Security. This conglomeration of airport screeners, Border Patrol agents, and other armed federal forces is a major purchaser of guns, and guns need bullets. So it's no surprise that DHS would make a bulk bullet buy. But it is somewhere way north of surprising that it purchased 1.6 billion bullets. You might wonder, is that a lot? Well, at the police agency's present use of 15 million rounds a year fired at its training centers and in the course of official duty, 1.6 billion is more than a 100-year supply of ammo. Or think of it this way. At the peak of the Iraq War, our Army was shooting 6 million rounds a month, so DHS is stockpiling enough for a 20-year hot war. Now, let's wonder about this. Why? Homeland Security, as its name states, is a domestic force, so what war is it anticipating? Also, these 1.6 billion bullets are not just little poppers. Forbes magazine notes that they include hollow point rounds that are even outlawed for use in war, as well as, quote, a frightening amount of bullets specialized for snipers. Again, why? DHS says blandly that they get a better price on a big buy. Another theory is they're doing it because they can. Congress will okay any purchase wrapped with a Homeland Security ribbon. And then there's the conspiracy theorists who say that we the people are the target of the buildup. This is Jim Hightower saying, I don't buy that, but the question remains, why? Shouldn't someone in Congress be inquiring?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org. Some consider it un-American to like anything about those namby-pamby European nations. But still, let's hear it for the Swiss. In a March referendum, the mild-mannered, pacifist-minded Swiss people rose up and hammered their bank executives who've been grabbing rip-off pay packages. Two-thirds of voters emphatically shouted yes to a maverick proposal requiring that shareholders be given the binding say on executive pay. Violators of the new rules would sacrifice up to 6 years of salary and face 3 years in jail. That's hardly namby-pamby. Indeed, it's America's lawmakers and regulators who've been squishy soft on banksterism. None of the Wall Street titans who enriched themselves with rip-off pay packages while running financial scams that wrecked our economy have even been pursued by the law, much less put in jail. It's no surprise, then, that they've gone right back to scamming and grabbing rip-off pay. Hardly a week goes by without another revelation of big bank fraud, yet the banks just pay an inconsequential fine and the culprits skate free. Forget too big to fail. Banks have become too big to jail. Our nation's top prosecutor, Attorney General Eric Holder, recently conceded that finagling financial giants are being given a pass. It does become difficult for us to prosecute them, he testified. We are hit with indications that if we do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, just four banks, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo, put nearly $20 million into last year's elections, mostly to back Republicans promising to weaken the few feeble restraints we now have on banker thievery. Our lawmakers and regulators want to coddle the big bankers. With such keystone cops overseeing them, why would any Wall Streeter even think of going straight?
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
So I hope you enjoyed and were stimulated by those two comments from Jim Hightower. He is a populist syndicated columnist and has his own newsletter and so on, JimHightower.com, if you want more information about him, as I just said. Okay, back to local Dearborn and Dearborn Heights and surrounding area issues. Here in Dearborn, definitely the Dearborn Board of Education is moving forward with what they call a smart bond, because it's the smart thing to do. Bad joke. I'm not sure what S-M-A-R-T stands for, but the bottom line is, folks, if approved, it won't raise your taxes, okay? And it's primarily for needed safety improvements and building upgrades. No, it's not adding, apparently, additions of room space on any of the schools in Dearborn. But they're taking the maintenance money needed out of the general fund, and they're going to have it in this bond that hopefully keeps getting renewed by the voters. And it's true, $76 million. But, as they state, because the money is coming out of the general fund, and there's already a bond in place, which are sort of switching over to the next one here. If approved, it won't raise your taxes. So that seems to be a no-brainer about voting for. Now, and we said this last week, why does it have to be August? Because there's going to be a millage for the schools to be renewed and one for Henry Ford Community College in November. Why not just put it on the same one? Well, the odds are there's going to be an election in November, in August anyway, so there's no extra cost to the school district, really, because there's runoffs. It's a primary election for people on city council, maybe also for the mayor's race if they get more than two challengers to Mayor O'Reilly. So fine, but you know, here's the story from the Patch.com, and it's also in the Press and Guide. That they still don't know if they're going to do it in August or November. So nothing like making decisive actions. And then even after the newspaper story was written, even after they heard the details from Whiston and Dave Mustonen, the PR guy, trustee Amy Scholes said, you know, we should be in November. because more people turn out. And then good old trusty Hussein Berry. And I'm being slightly ironic here or disparaging. I don't mean to. But you two folks weren't paying attention, I guess, in the meetings. It has to be in August, or 20 to 30 staff positions have to be eliminated. Whiston said that. They need the money, since they're not going to have it in the general budget. They need the money in August for the beginning of the school year. It's quite clear that they have to lay off 20 to 30 employees. There'll be a $5 million deficit if they don't pass this in August. Okay? So it's a no-brainer here, folks, if you were paying attention.
And it's a renewal.
Yeah, Dennis, let's get you official.
No, it's a renewal. I think that's a key part of this.
Well, they're playing games by switching money, and then there's a bond issue that's coming off. But basically, there's no increase.
Right. Thank you. That's exactly what it's going
on. No increase here. So yes, Amy Hussein, right, we all want to be Democratic, but, you know, not everybody's registered to vote, and a majority never even votes, not even in a presidential election year. I'm sorry, but that's the facts, Jack. At least majority never even gets of everybody out there who could register to vote, never really expresses their opinion. We don't know what the majority would ever do if they ever actually voted to express their opinion. So this is not really democracy anyway. But yes, there would be more people voting. But come on. I think when the message is clear, there's no increase. Just a different way to get the maintenance done on schools, which everybody would have to agree is absolutely essential.
Right. And they break it down.
And they do. So we'll come back to this. But I wish people would pay attention when they get to a board meeting. I know if you're watching this on cable, you often nod off. So it's tough.
Never.
Well, not if it's a cable show on Dearborn Heights.
You got or Dearborn.
Dennis's camera work and editing is so hot. You can't fall asleep.
Boy. Okay. Anyway, let's move on.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, and I didn't tell Dennis about this, but there's a couple events coming up here. Did you have the word about the movie?
It's full.
Oh, it's full.
Dr. Dare said it is completely full, but he would like to come on the show in the future with Dr. Nabil Abraham and Dr. Ahmad Nouri to talk about this. So they are...
About that movie?
About the movie and about the discussion afterward, because apparently it's an open forum afterward.
We have some open time before May 14th, and we'll get busy with candidates. But nonetheless, would love to. Again, Michael Dare and others... the story?
Yeah. Yeah, it's right under here. Okay. There you go.
Okay. And the date was changed once, but apparently a lot of people did hear about the screening of Five Broken Cameras, which is an Academy Award-nominated foreign film from the Middle East, and I really wanted to see it, but of course I didn't get reservations. It was directed by a Palestinian director and an Israeli director. Who says they can't work together, you know?
Well, they did on this particular project, didn't they?
Right. Yeah, so that's worthy of an Academy Award right there, or a nomination at least. Dr. Nabil Abraham with our Honors College, and Ahmad Nouri, who's the new head of the counseling division.
Sure.
And I think, is that called an associate VP now? Something like that. But in any event, along with Michael Dar from the English department, and I bet he's a title here. He's Arab Cultural Studies Program Director, probably. Doesn't say director, but he's in charge of the Arab Cultural Studies Program. And so whether you're Arab or not, Arab American or American Arab or not, these are some great cultural experiences, and they're going to have discussions afterwards, and maybe we can get a report from them in the future on the show.
Yeah.
I bet there'll be some spirited discussions, especially, you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, a lot of people hear about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and they have not really heard both sides fairly presented.
You could say that about most stories, don't you think?
Right. Yeah. Well, the media does tend to favor one or the other, and they shouldn't, of course. And if you follow international news, let's say from the CBC in Canada or BBC America, you get a very balanced view on what's happening in the Middle East and elsewhere, but not on U.S. media. Of course, not MSNBC and not, of course, Fox News, because they sort of slide to their political bias.
Right.
Of Democratic Party view and Republican Party view, or even more conservative or more liberal at times.
So NPR might be the best we can
NPR
do.
Is the best example from United States media, yeah. right, on what's really happening. But so it's good, in, especially in this community, that we continue sharing these ideas. And certainly we've got people that can testify to what's going on in the Middle East directly because of recent immigration and or connections with family. So
excellent.
Yeah. Just a little advance date, a week from Monday, April Fool's Day, by the way.
Monday is.
Yeah, April 1st. But I'm not fooling about this. It's going to be on April 8th, a week from Monday. City of Dearborn is inviting the public to come in for an informational meeting on the train station district over there on the edge of West Dearborn, okay, where the new train station is being built. And they're going to go over the updates on conceptual plans for the development of the area, not just the building itself of the train station. And there'll be a chance to provide feedback on the final design recommendations. It's going to be in Studio A, their little multipurpose room, of the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on Monday, April 8th, a week from Monday, from 7 to 9 p.m., and is open to pretty much everybody, residents, business owners, commuters who work in Dearborn, college, university students, and other Dearborn stakeholders. I prefer turkey, but whatever. The meeting is part of the transit-oriented development, TOD. Hi, Todd. Initiative that seeks to capitalize on the new train station's ability to draw more visitors, businesses, and residents. So it has to be a good plan. There's a lot of good ideas, and they'd like to have your input if you want to do it. 7 to 9, a week from Monday at the center. Okay.
All right.
Right. Now, I would like to take the time, because this story, Dennis, is, and he's, I'm reaching way back. I'm reaching back to February, actually.
Oh.
February 27th. This is the story of Detroit's socialist mayor, presented by Jack Lessenberry in one of his columns.
Didn't you recently bring this up?
I brought it up, but I never got a chance to do it on the air.
Wonderful.
I can't. So here, listen to this, and it might finish up the hour. And Highway 61, the best in the blues, with Joanne Korchinska is coming up, starting at 2, going till 6, of course. But take a listen. This is from the Metro Times, February 27th. Just as true today, though. Once, a long time ago, there was a mayor of Detroit who got it right. He figured out what was wrong, mainly government corruption and corporate greed. More importantly, he figured out how to fix it. He had no political experience. He was a little fat man with a pale face, scraggly beard, and cold blue eyes. To the end of his days, he called himself a conservative Republican. His opponents, sounding very much like today's Tea Party lunatics, and again, this is Jack Lessenberry's opinion, folks, so don't blame me, called him a socialist. He didn't give a damn. And I'm quoting Jack Lessenberry. Okay?
So it's okay.
Yeah. He helped the poor. He had no use for big corporations, and for 7 glorious years as mayor of Detroit, he kicked their, and we can't say that word,
right.
You know what. His name, and, you know, could this guy ever get elected today with TV, media, and all that? You know, he was short, he was fat, scraggly beard, and his name was Hazen Pingree.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Right. Hazen Pingree, P-I-N-G-R-E-E. He wasn't a politician, but a shoemaker. And he wasn't from Michigan, originally, but Maine.
Oh.
Ping, as he nicknames him here, Pingree, came here almost by accident. He was in a prison camp during the Civil War, listening to some fellow POWs from Detroit talk about what a great place it was. Now, that means Southern prison camp.
Sure, because
he was in the Union Army. Yeah, so, okay. So he met some people from Detroit, and they said it was a great place. When the war ended, he moved here. Ping, everybody called him Ping, started making shoes. He started making shoes. 20 years later, he was the second biggest shoe manufacturer in the nation.
Okay.
Ping's Shoes,
right.
Or the Ping Shoe Company. I don't know what they call it, but great.
Second only to Nike. No, I'm sorry.
So now whenever you hear the game Ping Pong, you know that he's the first half of it.
That's right.
But he didn't create that. No.
Yeah.
But the city he lived in, and when was this, you say? Give me. Okay, it's coming up. 1890.
Okay.
1890, all right, 23 years ago. But the city of Detroit that he lived in was deeply corrupt. Detroit was being run by private utilities and bar owners and a deeply corrupt city council. People and businesses were charged high rates for inferior service. Money disappeared. Detroit in 1890, the year he took office, had only 4 paved streets. Everything else was mud or rotting logs. Pingree made no extravagant promises. He just got it done. He figured out a way to spread tax increases out over several years and to float bonds to pave the streets. He set up stings to catch corrupt interests who were offering the councilmen bribes. He took on utilities, forcing them to roll back their rates for natural gas and electricity. After years of struggle, he forced the streetcar company to charge people less. He said he learned that corporations, quote, had to be kept in their proper place. It is not safe to entrust the government of the country to Wall Street, unquote.
Wow.
The corporations were shocked. Pingree had no tact. He was not charming. Unlike President Obama, who seems to have learned over and over again that the right-wingers have no intention of compromising or bargaining in good faith, Pingree didn't try for smooth compromises with the forces lined up against him. He just did what was right, appealed to the people, and plowed straight ahead. His crowning success came when he decided the city should have its own public lighting plant. If you go back and read the attacks of the opposition, you'd swear today's Tea Party wrote them all. Pingree was a socialist. He was destroying the Constitution. Freedom would be dead, they said. When Detroiters went to the polls, get this, Pingree was elected by 92%.
And they probably
had was the other schmuck running against him? Oh my God! They approved of what he was doing. Later that year, a severe depression hit the nation, which was the Panic of 1893. Detroit's workers were especially hard hit. Nobody then thought government had any obligation to do anything for the poor. Hayes and Pingree, years ahead of his time, thought otherwise. He ordered all city land plowed up, including the city hall lawn, so the poor could plant vegetables, especially potatoes. He asked the city's churches for help. After they coughed up a mere $13.80, he sold his prized racehorse and used the money to buy seed and supplies. They called them Pingree's Potato Patches, and they were a great success. Whole families, this is a quote from A Popular History of Detroit, published at that time, whole families could be seen planting, hoeing, and weeding, and when fall came, they harvested a large crop of potatoes, squashes, turnips, sweet corn. Now, Lessenberry goes on, no mayor ever did more for the city of Detroit. Pingree then wanted to be governor. For several years, conservatives blocked his nomination until two things happened. Business and corporate leaders in Detroit wanted Ping out of the city. They knew they could never beat him, but they persuaded the Republican bosses that the lobbyists and entrenched special interests in Lansing could easily buy off the legislature and prevent any of his reforms at the state level. Plus, they realized they needed the state's only really popular Republican to head the ticket in the fall of 1896. So Pingree ran and was elected by a landslide to be governor. Bizarrely, he thought he could still be mayor as well as governor and did both jobs for a few weeks until the Michigan Supreme Court said he had to quit one job. So he turned his energies to the state. Unlike many today, Pingree was a purely self-made but not selfish man. He especially wanted to make the railroads, which completely dominated transportation, to start paying their fair share of taxes. He told the legislature he wanted to end child labor and establish an 8-hour workday. He wanted a graduated income tax so the rich would pay their fair share, which Lessenberry adds, something Michigan still doesn't have.
Right.
Unfortunately, he almost completely failed. The corporate interests of the day were a lot like Matty Maroon, but a lot smarter. They didn't spread money around. They just bought a majority of the state Senate, who blocked just about everything Ping tried to do, despite a popular outcry. Ping did manage to get a state constitutional amendment passed, which led to eventual taxation and regulation of the railroads, and he managed to get more money for the schools. Otherwise, he was frustrated. After 4 years, he quit, telling the legislature that unless something was done to change how vastly unfair things were, quote, in less than a quarter century, there'll be a bloody revolution in this great country of ours, unquote. With that, he went off to Africa in 1901 to hunt elephants, stopped in Germany to study reforestation, and sadly, he got sick and died there. Thousands of school children donated pennies to build a statue to the only governor they knew who cared. And that statue today sits in Grand Circus Park.
Cool.
But nobody remembers Hazen Pingree, it seems.
The listeners of this show will never forget him.
I hope so. Hazen Pingree, or Ping, he was, as it says here, this is an inscription on his statue, he was the first to warn the people of the great danger threatened by powerful private corporations, and the first to awake to the great inequities in taxation and to initiate steps for reform. Takes my breath away.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Dennis, can you sum up something here? What have we missed? I see. Yeah, have something.
Well, no, I had something from again back in Dearborn Heights that we didn't touch on, but you have something.
Just very briefly. Great story in the Press and Guide from this Wednesday. Henry Ford Community College students have actually, in the architecture program, have actually set up a relationship with the city of Dearborn, and they're collaborating on the design and outfitting to restore an historic home in West Dearborn. And what a great real world project. Of course, I also commend Habitat for Humanity, which I think is building 12 or 13 new homes in Dearborn, just because the city got them to come in, and you know it's all volunteer labor, and just somebody provides the wood, I guess, and
right.
And so that's wonderful collaboration, and what a great real world project, sort of like our radio station, huh? For telecom students here at Henry Ford Community College, and of course we accept volunteers from the community too, you know. In the future, we're going to talk about the non-traditional career seminar coming up again for men here
we'll
at HFCC.
Diane Green will be on our show.
Right, on April 24th, the seminar is going to happen. Vicki Markovich, who is the superintendent for education at Oakland County Intermediate School District, I think it is. She's got a great essay in the Press and Guide, Public Education Isn't Broken. Because, you know, you might think because everybody's cutting teacher salaries and cutting the budgets of schools, they must be doing something wrong.
Right.
If you're cutting the budget, you're trying to punish them for something, aren't you? No. They're doing the best job they can. And, boy, could they do a better job, in my humble opinion, if they had more money for various appropriate things. Oh, well. But that's a great thing. It's in... You know, they add supplements. It's on page 14, and who knows whether it's supplement A or B or C. It's a supplement that is largely a PR for, like, businesses that the Press and Guide has. You know, it's supposedly helpful articles, but you can tell that it's always angled towards...
More of a spotlight on.
One business and like, there's always also a supplement about travel. Well,
sure.
Of course, it's every article is like, oh, here's a... You should take a trip to Costa Rica. Well, it's from the Costa Rica Chamber of Commerce or something, you know. And,
right.
And so it's kind of self-serving. But I don't see how this is. She's a superintendent, publicly elected, Vicki Markovich. Public education isn't broken. We just need to help support it. Okay. So thank you very much for tuning in to the new WHFR Journal today. Thank you, Dennis, for... coming by, and it's important about Dearborn Heights.
No, it's just they're thinking about getting a collection agency to go after the $164,000 in personal property taxes that are outstanding.
Oh yeah,
and a big reason, like property tax. So this is movable things, like mostly for businesses.
Dearborn Heights has personal property tax, personal income tax.
They do personal property tax, and
personal
property tax. Okay. So this is mostly for business owners, and of course that went through.
We'll have to ask Mayor O'Reilly on the 19th of April about. The situation in Dearborn. Do they have any collection problems?
I would love
regard?
To know that, but I think that this stems from the city has no money to begin with. They listen, they lost because of the budget cuts. They lost to somebody in the treasurer's office, and they're only a four-day work week, so I don't blame them for having problems.
Well, yeah, okay. I understand. Well, thank you, Dennis. We'll come back to that. Certainly, not only does the tax system have to be fair, but people have to pay the taxes.
Absolutely, and I'd love to have Mayor O'Reilly on the Dearborn Heights News and Views as well.
I'm sure he'd love to fill you in.
Did I say O'Reilly? Treasurer Riley. Sorry about that.
Treasurer Riley. Okay, there's a difference.
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. So let's say that it's WHFR Dearborn, and it's now time for Highway 61. We'll catch you next week. Be careful out there. Happy Easter for those that celebrate that.
Or Esther.
Yes.